In April, I was in my sitting room when I got the phone call to say one of my closest friends had died. I thought initially there was some mistake, that the caller, who was a mutual friend, had mixed me up with someone else. Maybe he'd gotten the number wrong, or this was some elaborate hoax or prank. Ha ha, good one. I remember having to sit down on the couch to try and physically take on board the details. Brian was dead. He was sorry. It looked like, well, you know. There wasn't much more he could say. The coded unsaid was clear. Brian and I had been friends for close to 20 years. We were both blow-ins to Cork. He was from Dublin, me from Ennis, and I suppose we shared something of an outsider's view of our adopted city. We both became fathers at roughly the same time. We lived together at times, we took holidays together, we shared a passion for boxing and Bob Dylan. Over the years, we developed our own wink and nod language of delight, our own shorthand, and we'd jokes that ran for years and years. At one point, Brian got a dog, and for years afterwards, we pretended he had actually ordered a cat. And every time I called to Brian, we'd both look at the dog, this big old Labrador, and we'd tell each other the same joke. I'd say, "That really is the funniest kitty I've ever seen, Brian." And he'd say something like, "Well, look, the guy in the rescue centre assured me it was a cat." Silly stuff, I know, but jokes that only we got. I knew Brian had depression over the years. He was quite open about it. I knew too last year he struggled during the summer. He phoned me to say he wasn't in a good place. He was heading into the emergency department, but he was okay, he didn't need anything, and not to worry. We chatted about it a week later, and I always remember him saying to me, "I had to get help. I surprised myself how dark a place I had gotten into." But he had counselling organised and he seemed to be back to his own self. He came to my 40th birthday that summer, and as he always did, he brought his guitar and he played and he sang. Birthdays, weddings, New Year's Eve, Brian was always there with a guitar. I knew his songs off by heart, like this one, which, when I listen to it now, of course all I can hear is depression.
And you know sometimes we can admit that all the barriers broken down, just how hard it can get when the walls we build are too high to climb. Oh yeah, I know we're only running up that hill only to find.
Ultimately, the hill proved too high for Brian to run up. In the days and weeks after he died, the grief hit me in waves, crashing violently at first, unrelenting, then getting into its own rhythm, ebbing and flowing. I could have done more. I should have done more. Why wasn't I more present? The day he died, I was working very close to his house, and it crossed my mind to call up to him. I didn't. We hadn't seen each other as much in the weeks before he died. Now I know it's because he was struggling. I wasn't alert enough to it. Suicide leaves so many questions, and part of me will probably always feel guilt. Always feel I could have done more, could have been a better friend, could have saved him. I've often reported on the need to be upfront around issues to do with mental health, and yet here it was hiding in plain sight beside me, and I couldn't see it, or I didn't want to see it. I felt like such a hypocrite, still do. I'd never told Brian I loved him. It's not a thing Irish male friends did. And yet the grief was so raw, so uncontrollable, it was clear that I did. Previous to this, the only grief I'd felt was when my grandparents had died, and although that was emotional, they'd lived long lives. Brian was 46, a father to a beautiful daughter I'd known since she was a toddler. I wanted to talk about grief, to try and make sense of this emotion we'll all experience. After the initial days and weeks passed, I remember sitting one day in a coffee shop and thinking grief was actually quite a beautiful thing on one level. It takes you by the hand and it shows you how much you really cared for someone.
We're only running up that hill, yeah, yeah, yeah. We're only running up that hill.
I'm looking to make sense of my own grief, especially at this time of the year when grief is so present for many people. One of the first people I meet is Cork singer-songwriter Jack O'Rourke.
I suppose, as a songwriter, grief is probably one of those emotions that's unavoidable.
It is, because, you know, I suppose whatever you experience in your own life, and I process things, I suppose, through music, you know, it helps me to deal with certain things that happen, you know, without it being therapy either, because I think that diminishes it as art. But I think it's certainly a great tool for everybody. You know, some people, my mom likes to Hoover. That's how she deals with it. I write songs.
I suppose if someone dies, a lot of time people will put on their favorite song, or they'll use music as a means of filtering their own grief or their own emotions.
It's a mystery to me still, but it's just got this universal quality that brings people together to grieve or to worship or to celebrate. And it's a very visceral thing, you know, it's very personal as well. And I don't know whether it's the notes or the arrangement, and I'm not a religious person, but when I hear plain chant, you know, or choral singing in a church, there's something very spiritual about that. I don't know why. I think even when I'm a secondary teacher too, but whenever we sing The Parting Glass, especially the version by the Voice Squad, I don't know if it's the chords in that song or the words are so beautiful, and then when it's married with those notes and the kind of repetition of it, it strikes a chord, I think, with everybody, you know. There's a line in it that says, since it falls into my lot that I shall rise and you should not, I'll gently rise and I'll softly call.
Since it fell into my lot that I should rise and you should not.
There's a great line as well in Bowler to Birmingham by Emmylou Harris, which is her dealing with her mentor, Graham Parsons, who was credited for kind of inventing country rock. He overdosed in the Joshua Tree Desert, and she kind of couldn't make sense of that. And she had a lot of guilt about that, actually, that she wasn't there maybe to save him. But there's a line in it that says, you really got me this time, and the hardest part is knowing I'll survive. I think with grief, there's a sense that the person that's left, it's a minefield. How does one go on? You know, in her case, it was, how do I go on musically? But she'd lost one of her soulmates as well. So there's a great void there that has to be filled.
One of the songs people often talk about, of course, is Eric Clapton's Tears in Heaven. It's a response to the death of his son, Connor.
Mm. Yeah, that's just such a beautiful song. You know, it's been like all great songs, I think a lot of people have tried to cover it, but the original version by him is so beautiful. And it's you know, that just that refrain, would you know my name if I saw you in heaven. You know, I suppose when his son was so young when that happened, when that terrible accident happened, that he will only ever know his son at that age. You know, it's that whole idea, I suppose, that if you lose a parent or two, you're an orphan. But there's no word in any language, you know, from Zulu to Irish, of a parent outliving their child, because it obviously happens, but it goes against the natural order of things.
Would you hold my hand if I saw you in heaven?
There's lots of, I think, country songs and blues, R&B songs that deal with just everyday hardships, you know. There's a great song by Aris Dement called Easy's Getting Harder Every Day. I think Townes Van Zandt said it, there's two types of music, the blues and Zippity Doodah. A lot of people say my music is dark, and I definitely gravitate to darker songwriters, but I think it's because the reality of life is that it can be hard. This is a song written by Colin Vermcombe, who went under the name Black, the stage name. He lived in Skull, and his family very kindly allowed me to sing this for this program. The music is so catchy, you know, and yet the lyrics are dealing with something quite, you know, dark for me when I listen to it. Everyone has their own interpretation of it. So this is my version of Wonderful Life by Colin Vermcombe, a.k.a. Black. Here I go out to sea again. The sunshine fills my head and dreams hang in the air. Gulls in the sky and in my blue eyes, you know it feels unfair. There's magic everywhere. Look at me standing here on my own again, up straight in the sunshine. No need to run and hide. It's a wonderful, wonderful life. No need to laugh and cry. It's a wonderful, wonderful life. Sun's in your eyes, heat is in your hair. They seem to hate you because you're there. I need a friend, oh, I need a friend, to make me happy. Not stand here on my own. Look at me standing here on my own again, up straight in the sunshine. No need to run and hide. It's a wonderful, wonderful life. No need to laugh and cry. It's a wonderful, wonderful life. No need to run and hide. It's a wonderful, wonderful life. No need to laugh and cry. It's a wonderful, wonderful life. Wonderful, wonderful life.
While music may or may not be therapeutic, you often hear the saying, time is a great healer. I went to County Clare to meet Joan Shannon, who is facing into her third Christmas living with grief.
Hi, Brian.
Joan, how are you?
Welcome.
This is the dog.
This is my dog. You're not afraid of dogs, I presume?
No. Should I be?
No. No.
Listen, thanks for having me. How are
not
you?
Not at all. I'm okay. Mornings are the worst. Afternoons, I kind of come around a little sometimes. I'd normally be out on the road by now. Yeah, no, you can't have that. Can't have that. Sit. Sit. Good boy. Don't be a nine, Brian.
So tell me a bit about yourself then. You have how many children?
I have four sons. So I have. They're all good and all healthy, thank God.
And tell me about how you met Greg and when.
We met briefly at the Queen's Hotel at a nightclub. He asked me to dance. And I didn't dance. That was the beginning of it.
And things move very quickly from there.
Things move very quickly from there, yes indeed. That was kind of into September, October. And we got married on the 17th of January.
14 weeks.
Yeah, about 14, 16 weeks. Yes, yes we did. I suppose, I don't know, was it faith, whatever it was, I don't know. Was he the one? Yes, he was, definitely. And we had a great life. Great life, I have to say. So we were married for 30 years. And then he got ill. Biggest thing for Greg having cancer wasn't having cancer. The biggest fear that he had was leaving us. So, and I'll never forget it. He said to me, you know, He said, I'm not afraid of the cancer, he said, John. He said, but, you know, and to the boys as well, he said, do you know what I'm afraid of? He said, is leaving ye. He said, I don't want to do that. So we discussed it, me and the boys and him. And I said, you know what? That'll never happen.
So everybody who was in that room, including the staff, mm-hmm. were all told,
yeah.
you're not to tell him he's dying.
No, no. Every minute, every second, we didn't never left him.
And the last thing you said to Greg?
The last thing I said to Greg was, I love you.
And then Greg died on the...
Greg died on the 15th of June, his mother's anniversary.
I suppose the one thing that you probably would have gotten if you had said this is the story mm-hmm. is that you would have got to say goodbye and maybe the grieving process would have been easier. I don't know if it's if you can ever make it easier, but...
Would I agree with that? Probably not. Not for me. I started grieving, really, the day Greg was diagnosed with cancer. Would I do it differently if it happened all over again? No, mm-hmm. I wouldn't. Because the one thing Greg never wanted to say was goodbye.
Tell me about grief then, because obviously you had four boys. You've got the funeral arrangements are made. There's a process that kicks into gear. I suppose there's one thing we do well in Ireland is funerals.
Yeah, you know, people give out about this shaking hands and whatever else. Without that, it was the outpouring of people. Do you know what I mean? And even until I experienced death so close to me, I didn't realise the emphasis on it and the importance of it.
How would you describe grief?
How would I describe it? Grief. There is no one word for it. Not for me. Grief is a roller coaster, to be honest with you. Grief, you learn to live with it, without a doubt, because I didn't think I'd last a day without Craig. Here I am 2.5 years down the road. Has it got easier? I'm learning to live with it. On the days that it's very bad, which a lot of people might agree it's different for everybody, I pretend he's not gone. The days that I can't breathe. And I suppose counselling helped. I did go to counselling, but I left it for a good while before I did. I think to talk about it is exceptionally good for people if you can. But people deal with it very differently, because I think to lose somebody that you loved, I mean, where are they gone, number one? And number two, I suppose you're so used to being with them, it's like losing half of yourself. Do you know what I mean? It's like a tsunami. You could be fine for 2 hours and think, you know, I'm actually after taking a step forward. And then it's like this wave can hit you out of nowhere and you're 4 step backwards again. The way I deal with this, I talk about him a lot. I talk to him a lot. I give out to him a lot. But he would have wanted us to go on.
I suppose we want to give people some hope as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're 2.5 years down the road mm-hmm. now. This Christmas will be that little bit easier, will it?
It will. It will, because for the simple fact, you're not the same person that you were before. But then again, you have life to live, all right? That is denied to so many people. The way I look at it is, I'm not ill, thank God. My boys are all healthy, thank God. We have each other. As I said, I didn't think I would last 1 day without Craig. Not 1 day. And here I am 2.5 years.
One thing earlier this year when I lost my close friend, I couldn't help thinking about a little time afterwards was, in a way, grief is, it's a very unusual emotion because it's quite beautiful in one way, because it makes you realise just how much you cared for someone.
Without a doubt, without a doubt. And what it really showed me is that I suppose I was very fortunate to meet the love of my life. Have the love of my life. And, you know, some people never find that. You know, some people in life, you look at it now, I look at it and I can say that to you now. If you'd asked me that the first few weeks after Greg passed or the first few months, I couldn't look at all the beautiful things we did or the great times we had because it hurt me too much. So there again, that's the grief process. For the first few months or the first year, it's like you're underwater. That's how I felt. I felt like I was underwater and voices around me were very strange. But that's grief, because grief envelops you. It's like a cocoon, because it's your only way of getting through it. I suppose because we loved each other so much. But yeah, there is life after losing somebody. It's a different life. But yeah, you will get through it.
What would be your advice to people who may have lost someone relatively recently and they're dealing with Christmas at the moment?
Do it your way. I had a lot of people that said, go back to work, do this, do this, do this. I didn't do any of it. I did what I felt. And when I have a down day, I have a down day. And I do have quite a lot of them, or a down few hours. I need my time out. I don't pretend I'm okay. Don't pretend, because pretense can be harder than grief itself. Your friends and your family will help, and you need to be able to talk to them. Don't hide it. That's what I say. Don't hide your grief.
Having met with Joan, it seems she's a lot further down the road in processing her grief than I am. We're expected to grieve, though, for a member of our family, and we're given the space to do so. But when you lose a friend, you can sometimes fall outside of that hierarchy of grief that exists at funerals. In the 19th century, though, it was a far more communal event, as I discovered when I visited the National Folklore Collection.
Hello, welcome to the National Folklore Collection.
Thanks for having me in.
My name is Rina Hyogan. I'm the former director of the National Folklore Collection, and I'm an associate professor emeritus in Irish folklore.
Based on what's in the collection, do you think we grieve in Ireland any differently to other parts of Europe?
I think that grief and grieving are universal. They're very basic, natural reactions to the what might be regarded as the ultimate crisis in human existence, if we're talking about death. But I do think there are particular forms of grieving that are particularly expressive, maybe, of the Irish psyche. I think that the quina or the keen, the lament, for example, is particularly Irish. And I think that in historical terms, the way the community grieves and the way the family grieves, I think that is very particularly Irish. But that is not to say that similar ways of grieving do not exist in other places.
There are a number of really nice pieces of sound archive in the collection, one of which we can probably hear now.
Well, where would they lay out the corpse then, in the old days now?
Yes, in the coffin. And if it were the head of the house, his head would go towards the back door. And his feet towards the front. But if it was one of the family, that would go by the window, the front window.
Oh, I see.
And then when they put them up on a table, they used to put them.
Oh, on the table?
On a table, yes.
In the coffin?
No, not at all. Covered with a sheet or... No, the habit. They'd have the habit on them, on a table.
But, a table would hardly be long enough.
But they can put another onto it.
Oh, I see, yes.
There was one table in our village that used to go into every house.
They
had a long table, and that served every house in the village. Now, do you see, that table would be borrowed for the occasion.
I see, and they covered the table then with
But up over the corpse, all that would be in white sheets, and done up beautiful, white lace coming down out of them. You could see nothing but white over the side of the corpse.
Oh.
And the corpse would be laid on a table, as I told you, with the habit.
Because
then when they would have the corpse laid out, they'd start and they'd have a fine round of crying over that corpse immediately.
This whole business of funeral games, which caught my eye, we're not talking about Monopoly.
Well, the wake games, as they were known, Cahavamshire Thorav, an excellent book that Sean O'Sullivan, who was the archivist with the Irish Folklore Commission, wrote and which was published in the 1960s, describes some of the games. And they were so varied and so involved a great deal of physical activity, or some of them did. And they ranged from games of dexterity, and of course there was storytelling and music and song as well. And so much so that they were regarded in more recent times as something that people maybe wanted to forget in some way, and that they might be seen to be too happy or too almost celebrating the death or reflecting some kind of joy, whereas the death would be regarded as something that was so sad that games should not or ought not be played at the wakes. It helped distract people from what was actually happening in this terrible time of crisis. I think it helped pass the time that these wake games took place. They took the form of things like turf throwing, potato throwing, games that were maybe associated with the corpse, where people imitated the fact that there might be a corpse, and then they tried to lift the corpse off the ground.
People would actually try and lift the corpse.
Well, it was they pretended. Yeah. One person would lie down on the ground and pretend they were the corpse, and they would pretend they would lift the corpse then. There were games with sexual connotations, I suppose, where people, it was in fun, and a man would call out a girl's name and the girl would be expected to kiss another man. And there were mock marriages, mock trials.
And was this all happening in the room where the corpse was laid out?
This was happening either in the room or sometimes in a barn or sometimes outside. They were very, even from the description of them, I think we get the sense of that there were a number of people involved in each game, that it wasn't kind of one or two people, that it was generally a group. And those, should we say, that the community who were present, those who were present, were participating as well. So very often, you know, there would be 10 or 12 or more people participating in these games. They seem to be very physical, a lot of them.
And wakes, and there seems to be this tradition of waking people at home now, again, you know, that it's moving back towards that. People are more comfortable in their own homes.
I think the having the body at home for the wake is a very natural process, and I think it highlights the connection between the living and the dead, that the dead person is still maybe a part of the whole home situation. And I think that's reflected in having the wake at home in a way that it's not reflected in the more formal funeral parlour setup.
Having heard how some of the ways we deal with death and grieving in the past have carried on into the present, I was really struck by how the following two people dealt with their own grief. One of them is Mick Heaney, son of the late poet and Nobel laureate Seamus, while the second is Laura Kennedy, a writer for the Irish Times who lost her mother to cancer. I began by asking Mick Heaney just what it was like when his private grief for his father became something very public.
We're always vaguely aware that he was such a public figure that it was probably going to be a public event. But there were a couple of things. The radio was one of the things. I remember hearing, you know, Joe Duffy and I think Thomas Kinsella was on talking about it. That was a moment. People in Ireland are very good with funerals, I have to say. So a camera crew camped outside the house, and a friend of ours was there and came out and said, "Would you mind not camping outside?" And they moved off. So there was none of that intrusion, really. That was great. And as the days went on, I think there's that thing where the private grief, which I think was pretty much the same as anyone, we were in the house, going back home, it added that weird overlay that you're sort of following these things on television, which I think grief is a surreal experience for everyone. You know, it's sort of like looking through a window screen at yourself, but that just added another dimension to it.
You mean, did it add a layer of unreality to it?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, or certainly hyper-reality. The day of the funeral, you know, we went to the funeral was a state funeral, effectively. It was on television, which was very strange. I don't think we really realised that it was going to be live on television.
And was there one moment during that when you, I don't know, came out of the car, arrived in the church, and you took it all in and thought, OK, I know what I'm dealing with now?
I think actually the moment where it really came out, what a weird day, was when we came back from the burial in Northern Ireland. And frankly, you know, it was all over the television. So you watched on the news, you watched the funeral you'd just been at. So it was strange.
And how did that affect your own grief?
I think oddly it probably aided it, you know. I think probably I was, and I'm sure we'll go into this, I think the grief that catches you isn't the obvious stuff. I think it probably helped me, and at that time in particular.
I mean, some of us have given eulogies. I gave one at my grandparents' funeral at both of them. It was a great honour to do it, but I did that in a small church in West Clare. You gave a eulogy, and obviously you're addressing your family and your friends and your father, but you had every radio station, every newspaper in the country broadcasting what you were saying.
Yeah, I didn't really think about that at the time, to be honest. I was doing what I think everyone at one of those eulogies thing is, like, I don't want to make a show of myself, whoever's there. You know, it's a matter of timing. I really didn't think much about the television. I just looked at the front row and kept at it there. So I think, again, that out-of-body experience of grief.
Laura, in your case, you wrote very early on about your mum's cancer diagnosis and then subsequently, obviously, her sad death. Why did you take that decision to turn something, it's almost the flip side of Mick, which was very private, and to make it public?
I've kind of thought about that a lot since I did it, and I'm still not entirely sure of the answer to that question, really. I think it was because it was so personal and so insular. And we were such a small family, just this unit of three people, that I thought, okay, as I think people often do when there's a diagnosis or a death in the family, they think, well, I have to get this out somewhere. And obviously I couldn't burden my mother with it, and my brother was dealing with his own stuff. So I thought, well, I write anyway. I did it with her blessing, and I kind of thought, well, possibly if I'm undergoing this, I'm certainly not the only one. So maybe some good can come of it.
And maybe if you would take me back to that morning when you got the phone call. It was a difficult morning for you because you got a phone call after your mum had died, and that's not what you wanted, obviously.
Yeah, it was one of those things, I think, when someone is moribund and you know it, you develop these habits that are sort of, what I suppose what anyone does when they feel out of control in this macro way, you get control over micro things. So I would sleep with the phone under my pillow, you know, as though that would bring me to greater proximity to her or make it more likely I'd be able to do something if the call came, which of course was entirely untrue. But yeah, so that morning, it was 6:30 in the morning, a freezing November morning, just the most hostile sort of weather you can think of, still dark, and the pillow judders. And I think you know it's coming to an extent because you've been told, and you see the person declining and becoming sicker. But there is always this level of consciousness on which it almost seems impossible until it happens. And once you reach those last kind of narrow days, you're never sure if it's going to be today. You might get another day. You might get another week. And you kind of live in the hope that that will happen. So when the phone call came, I thought it was going to be, you know, it's time, come now. But it had already happened. I'd missed the thing I'd been fearing for a year prior. I just got up, got dressed, and I was asleep across the street from the hospice, which kind of made it somehow worse because I couldn't have felt further away, and made my way over to kind of face the thing that I'd missed. And with this heavy awareness that this was the beginning of a process that I was just so entering so unconsensually, and that was going to have this incredibly long legacy. And I felt so tired and so unwilling to start the process, but off I went. What else can you do?
And I think what often catches people unawares who've been near death is while you're in that room and you're dealing with what's just happened outside the room, the world is continuing. You almost feel like shouting at it to stop, don't you?
Absolutely. I remember when I got to the hospice, the bedroom door had a photograph of a sunset on it, which is obviously their sort of euphemism for, you know, the thing has happened in here, you know, careful, tread carefully. And I kind of remember simultaneously thinking, oh, that's so vulgar, I hate that. And also, what way is there that isn't vulgar or insulting or that seems to minimise the situation? There is no way of declaring, you know, someone has died here, everybody shut up, other than, you know, some symbol.
We'll move on to talk a little bit about grief, because obviously inevitably with that there comes grief. But before we do that, we might just listen to Bob Geldof talking on the Late Late Show about the loss of his daughter Peaches. You might put on your headphones and we'll have a quick listen.
Time doesn't heal, it accommodates.
Right.
And, you know, again, I stress every single person probably has had something that they'd rather not have to deal with. But I think what happens, again, I visualise these things, and I think what happens is that the pain is always there. And at certain unwanted moments, unheralded moments, at times when you're in the most unlikely place, you're at a party with friends, and suddenly this overwhelming sense comes into your head. And it's like the subconscious has pushed itself into the foreconscious. And if you know what it is, if you don't let yourself be subsumed by it, you can take it out, you can look at it. So this is what I do, literally. Mm-hmm. If you can imagine, before there were UBS sticks, I sort of imagined it like that. And I take it out and said, I know who you are, you little, you know, get back in there. And you slot it back in that part of your head where these things live, your own sort of personal hell. And you can fit it back in there. There's space enough in your head for it. And that's how you can get on with it.
I think he probably meant USB sticks there, but we get the idea and we get the picture. How do you cope with grief? I mean, how do you deal with it, Mick?
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, regarding you know, Bob Geldof, the loss of a child, I think, is a different order of grief. I mean, even with Laura, though, your mother was much, much younger than my father. And I think losing a parent, it was a bit of a shock to us because he'd gone in for something else. And he then discovered he had to have a procedure. And we knew it was dicey. So he had about a day to get used to the idea that he could be going into something. So it was a shock when it happened. In terms of managing the grief, we went into the room and all of us just wept. You know, and in a way that was the really one massive cry. I mean, I cried now and again afterwards, but it all came out the moment I saw him. So in a way that probably helped. So I thought I managed grief pretty well. And then you get tripped up by the smallest things. But I think it's probably the same with other. I mean, I've heard people say it's not the anniversary that gets me. It's a wet Wednesday or something.
For you, Laura, was there that sense as well that grief was, if you like, hiding in the mundane?
We make an error in thinking about grief the wrong way. There are loads of sort of theories and ideas around what it is and how we're supposed to manage it. But I think we make a real error in thinking that it's linear. You know, there's no evidence that it is. And if you think about it that way, you do get this sense when you progress and you have one of those wet Wednesdays that you have regressed. And, you know, there's that disgusting Americanized concept of closure, you know, that you sort of finish grieving or finish bereaving, bereaving being bereaved. I don't think that happens. You know, I don't think you failed in any way if you never stop thinking about the person that you've lost. I think it's just what you do with it. You know, if it holds you back and if it prevents you from engaging in the present and appreciating the people you still have around you, then you're probably grieving the wrong way. But I don't think there's enough acceptance of, you know, that kind of stealthy ugliness it can have. And there's a bit too much respect for it too, in that grief is a liar sometimes. You know, I think especially in the earlier stages, it will draw your attention to very unreasoned and very emotional micro moments.
Like what?
For example, I wasn't there when my mother died, so I would have kind of these unbidden flashes of, was she afraid? And she might have been. You know, she probably was asleep. She was very heavily medicated. If I think about it rationally that way, that's the likely situation there. But if she was afraid, would my being there have made a difference? Probably not. You know, maybe it would have. But I think when a person dies, grief immediately makes you think about the things you didn't have, you know, the goodbye you didn't get, the lack of comfort the person might have experienced in certain instances. But and we sort of think, well, if I had that thing I didn't have, I'd grieve better.
And I think I read you saying somewhere that maybe we tend to poeticise grief, which brings me to Mick.
Well, it's funny what you said about it never, as it were, going away. I mean, in my father's last collection, which was 26 years after his mother died, there was poems about his mother then. I don't think poeticised grief is necessarily the way to... it makes it sound perhaps more exploitative than it is. But I think he, early on, dealt with it. He had lost his brother, Christopher, when he was... And there's that famous poem, Midterm Break, which I probably have a read of at some stage. But that's a good example, actually, of him, I think, of working things through. And actually, I think it conveys, I'm biased, but I think it does convey the kind of unreality of grief. Also, the final line in the poem is equally the unreality followed by the kick in the gut, you know?
Well, look, before we go any further, you might just read it for us, if you don't mind. And obviously, this is a poem about an uncle you never met.
Yes, this was my uncle Christopher, who, was age 4, as we'll find out, and he was knocked over by a bus. So, unfortunately, I won't be able to read this as well as my father, but we'll just have to make do. Midterm break. I sat all morning in the college sick bay, counting bells knelling classes to a close. At 2 o'clock, our neighbours drove me home. In the porch, I met my father crying. He had always taken funerals in his stride, and Big Jim Evans saying how it was a hard blow. The baby cooed and laughed and rocked the pram when I came in, and I was embarrassed by old men standing up to shake my hand. And they tell me they were sorry for my trouble. Whispers informed strangers I was the eldest, away at school, as my mother held my hand in hers and coughed out angry, tearless sighs. At 10 o'clock the ambulance arrived with the corpse, stanched and bandaged by the nurses. Next morning I went up into the room. Snowdrops and candles soothed the bedside. I saw him for the first time in 6 weeks. Paler now, wearing a poppy bruise on his left temple. He lay in the 4-foot box as in his cot. No gaudy scars, the bumper knocked him clear. A 4-foot box, a foot for every year.
I think you described it to me on the phone the other day as a showstopper. I mean, it really is a showstopper, isn't it?
I mean, you know, I didn't know him, and I just even there, I find myself, you know, let's not make a show of herself at the end there. That's the type of raw grief which I didn't experience.
I mean, I suppose it is important to say, and it's something we focused on in this program, like, it is important to say there is life after loss, because otherwise, if you allow yourself to be weighed down by that loss, well, then life is very, very different, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it helps as well not to try to calcify the memory of the person you've lost. You know, I'm not sure if it's a particularly Irish habit, but it is an Irish habit to, you know, sanctify people once they've died. And you forget all of the often terrible behaviours and traits they had, and sometimes terrible things they did. But you also kind of lose a lot of the fun and the substance of who they were in that. My mother wasn't my property. You know, I'm really conscious that she had probably a terribly interesting and much more mischievous life before me than she ever admitted to in my presence. And sometimes meeting people who knew her from that time, they will tell me something about her that I didn't know. And I think, oh, you scamp, you never told me that. So I think it really helps you to move on. And by move on, I mean carry them forward with you, not, you know, leave it, you know, cut it from your back and go off along the road. to remember that they weren't your property, but that they're everyone's property to an extent, and the memory is rounded by sharing it with other people. And of course, like, you know, a bit of Seneca in that letter that he wrote to a friend of his who had lost a friend, his sentiment was pretty much, you know, what was the friendship for if you don't remember it? You know, there's nothing more certain than what has been in the past. Nobody can take that from you. It's yours. And everybody has their version of the person they've lost and their memories of them. And that keeps a certain presence for you. And that makes it a bit easier to be without them, I think.
Listening to Mick and Laura, it's clear to me there are different versions of grief, just as there are different stages of life. There's a natural order to death, but losing someone before time, the grief is all the more difficult to process. You feel somehow cheated. A couple of weeks ago, just over 6 months after my friend Brian died, I called to see his 17-year-old daughter, Fia, whom I've known since she was a toddler.
My dad was someone who would make you laugh, but at the same time, you'd be like telling him to shut up because he'd probably be trying to annoy you. My dad was someone who was always like there for you, I suppose, even though you'd think he's not listening, but he probably was. He's someone whose music you never really appreciated unless you weren't with him listening to it. He was someone who I feel had a talent that he didn't show off. He was kind of modest, but at the same time, he was kind of cocky. But he was a special person, I think.
Oh, it's never too late to change your mind. Never too late to change your mind and stay.
It's now 6 months since your dad died. How would you describe grief? There's probably different types of grief during that 6 months, was there?
I think it's kind of an awake nightmare sometimes, and other times it's surreal, but I feel that you try to cover up how you feel about it, like you don't want to think too much into it, but then other times it takes over your day, or it could take over a few days, but at the same time you kind of let it because you feel like you need to give it more thought. Then there's the stage of kind of anger that this is what has happened and this is what you have to deal with, and it's different waves of different emotions, I think. It's kind of the days where something special happens and you're kind of thinking like, why aren't they here? Every single Christmas he'd always have a big surprise for me. It would be something completely that I wouldn't even thought of asking for.
Do you listen to your dad's music now?
Yeah, surprisingly I do. Like, the first few times I listened to it, I was kind of 10 seconds in and I was like, oh no, I can't listen to this. But now I find myself when I'm just going to put on music, just putting them on, or like some days I can listen to them and it's just like background music, but then other days you listen properly and you're kind of, I try to put together what he was he trying to say something in his music, or, you know, was this his way of expressing himself? And then there's other days where I'll just sit there and I won't even be listening, but I'll just be upset and I don't know, they'll make me happy, but they make me sad as well, I suppose.
What's been the hardest part of the last 6 months? Was there any particular day when you thought, God, I just really can't do this?
When I think of my dad taking his own life, I don't think of him. Like, I still see the same person, but I feel like if I was sat in a room with him and his back was turned to me and they were talking to me, and I would feel like it was a completely different person, because I don't think my dad would want to have put like all this sadness on all our family. Like, I feel like the person that took his own life was my dad, and it was the same body, but it wasn't the same mind. And I know that's obvious, but I just feel like something took over him. Like, it, I can't imagine talking to that person because I don't think it would be the same person that I knew as my dad. Like, I, when I think of my dad taking his own life, I think of, like, that was Brian. Like, it wasn't dad. Like,
and it's never too late to change your mind, never too late to change your mind and stay.
So what have I learned about my grief in the making of this program? I know that for me, when I lost Brian, in a paradoxical way, it brought me closer to him than I had ever been. It's just a shame that we have to lose someone sometimes to truly realise how much we care for them and what they mean to us. I don't know if grief can ever be a good thing. Nothing prepares us for it. I end the year a different person than I was at the start of it. I feel buoyed by the fact that, as we've heard, people do learn to live with grief, to file it away, to not be weighed down by it. Although it's okay to define your own personal relationship with grief and to share it as widely as possible. Through the grieving process, it's important to remember that while it may seem difficult to accept at times, there is life after loss. Take it away, Brian.